Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And we're starting out the program today. If you are, as we are, greatly stressed out about the disaster from Hurricane Maria and what was the other one?
Harvey.
There's another one, too. There were two in Puerto Rico.
Anyway, one hit the U.S. Virgin Islands before hitting
Florida coast. Harvey, and then there was Iris, I think.
Iris was that one, I guess.
Yeah, and then Maria, and another having after storms in Puerto Rico. I mean, it's awful. It's just awful. And a lot of chefs, as usual, the chefs are being generous with their time, their talent, their donations. They're just extraordinary as a profession. So we took to talking to chef restaurateur Christian Frangiatis, and wanted you to hear about his operations, his current operations, his very wonderful new Spork Pit barbecue operation, his future plans, his restaurant, his wonderful restaurant Spork, and also about the fundraiser that he's organizing along with some other folks, including his GM, Sean Enright, to help provide relief to the victims of these natural disasters. I would say that it was all in planning stage. So for further information or to sign up or on or however you call it.
Well, we'll have the information on a news page.
Okay.
As soon as we have it.
Right. But and also check Spork, SPORKPGH.com. Here's Chris. My dear friend, Christian Frangiatis, a chef I've known for quite a long time and chef restaurateur. His new venture is sparking all kinds of excitement, and I'm right there and Peter cheering you on, Chris. We wanted to talk to you about, we had such a wonderful evening at your Spork Pit, which is probably the most sophisticated barbecue venture to date, isn't it?
Yeah, I'd like to think so, sure.
Tell us about, right now it's out of doors at picnic tables under umbrellas, and as long as the weather's nice, that's just great. But and you're eventually going to move this indoors. Just tell us a little bit about that. What I liked about the outdoors is your neighbors would come by, you know, it was like, and, you know, they'd ask for something to eat, you'd tip them something.
Yeah, absolutely. And, I mean, a Spork Pit is really, it's an extension of where it grew kind of out of Spork, which is our normal restaurant, and that's a 50-seat indoor small plates restaurant. And we kind of went down to Austin, and we had some incredible barbecue at Franklin's and at some of the other places. We were just really inspired by the barbecue, and we had a little side lot next to the restaurant. We thought, geez, it'd be great to, try to tackle Texas barbecue or Central Texas barbecue in particular, that style, which is very underrepresented in Pittsburgh, and if we could make something out of it. And it just really came out of like a passion to try to do something really well.
Now, what is Texas barbecue?
So I think, you know, the hallmarks of it is that it's very beef-centric as opposed to pork-centric. Brisket is king.
I loved your brisket. Loved it.
Oh, well, thank you. Also, in addition to the brisket, one of the big things over there is that they frequently do, but usually it's like on more special occasions, like once a week, is the smoked beef ribs, the short ribs. And then the other hallmarks of it is homemade smoked sausage, smoked turkey. And then kind of the pork products are next in line in terms of importance. So there's, you know, ribs and there's pulled pork, which obviously everybody has. But I think in terms of importance for Texas barbecue, it really is beef brisket, smoked sausage, and smoked turkey. I think that's kind of a triumvirate.
Yeah, now you don't, I mean, people when you say barbecue think of something slathered with red sauce, and that's not it.
No, not at all. And I think that's another hallmark of Texas barbecue is that, well, certainly they do have sauce, and typically they have, you know, sauce bottles on the table that you're more than welcome to use. by no means are you required to use it, and you know, there's really quite an argument as to whether you should use it or not. The idea is that hopefully the stuff that comes out of the pit is smoked so perfectly and is so moist and flavorful that it doesn't really need any sauce.
Now you just mentioned the word pit, and I guess a lot of barbecue restaurants have exactly that. They have a fire pit inside the restaurant. I remember Arthur Bryant's in Kansas City.
Burnt ends on it.
They had a huge pit.
Yeah, they prided themselves on the fact that the barbecue pit had never
been clean.
been clean since it was constructed.
That was about 100 years ago, by the way.
Right.
But that leads me on to the other thing that's really special about what you decided to do, which was to invest in a real smoker. And smoke must be a big thing in Texas barbecue.
Yeah, I mean, I think that pit is probably the most important aspect of it. So what we did is we had an offset smoker hand-constructed for us by a guy named Robert Pierce, who has a company called Houston Smokers. And he hand-constructed this 17-foot offset smoker for us.
Yeah, it's a big mother.
it really is.
And you're getting another one there.
It looks a little bit like a tank. If you can remember, those of you who are old enough to remember Thomas the Tank Engine.
Yes, and actually we have a second one coming up next week.
Right.
We'll have double the capacity.
The only difference is they're black, they're not painted green.
Yeah, but I think, you know, the thing that makes the pit so important is really how it's engineered. Uh-huh. So
about this. When you get into something, you really go all the way and study it. Explain to us how you're controlling oxygen and all that stuff.
Well, that was the thing, is we wanted to make sure that the pit was constructed with two really big smokestacks that had a lot of draw. And when we cook with the firebox door open, and we don't have any kind of baffles or any kind of tuning plates or anything inside the pit to essentially control or restrict the smoke. So what we're going for is a hot, clean fire with smoke that is not acrid, that is sweet, that is very light in flavor. And that really comes by getting a lot of oxygenation, in the process. And that really is a result of the design of the pit. So I think that the pit design is critically important if that's what you're trying to achieve, which is what we are trying to achieve.
Yes. Now, what about the sides? I was so incredibly impressed that for your mac and cheese, you make your own pasta.
Yeah. Well, I mean...
Chris, really?
Normally that would kind of be a big deal, I guess. But the thing is with pork, which is, you know, right next door to the pit, we make every single thing. So our motto is no products. So we already make a lot of pasta for Spork, you know, homemade. We make a lot of bread already for Spork homemade. So we decided it would be an easy thing, considering we have a pasta cooker, considering we have pasta machines that we use to make our pastas. We thought, you know what, it's not going to be a difficult thing to make the macaroni for the macaroni and cheese. It won't be a difficult thing to make potato bread, sliced potato bread, serve that with the, with the barbecue.
Beans, red beans and rice, too.
Oh, yeah. Well, and then the other thing is the one place where we decided to sort of bury ourselves from the typical Texas barbecue is obviously they like baked beans, and quite honestly, I don't.
I don't either.
But I do have a wife who's Dominican and makes the most incredible beans and rice, or what she would say guandules, or otherwise known as pigeon peas. And so she does the rice and she does the beans, and those are pigeon peas with coconut milk and pumpkin. And,
oh, is that in there? No wonder it's good.
Yeah, and so her beans and rice are incredible, and I just thought it would be stupid not to serve them over there.
Now tell me this, what happens when it gets cold? And I've met somebody who has a building down the street. You're going to move in there?
Yes, that's correct. So right now, Spork Pit is only open 2 days a week. It's open on Wednesdays and Saturdays.
All day, though.
Yes, all day. But we will, in about 3 months, be moving it to a location about halfway down the block. We are revamping a very old building and putting a giant deck over the parking lot. So the majority of the seating will still be outside, as will the pits be outside, and all the cooking will be done outside. There will be a little indoor seating area with a liquor license, craft beers, and we'll be open at that point 6 days a week.
That's great.
In the meantime, we're going to continue to cook 2 days a week outside even through the winter until our building's ready, because we do have Spork right next door, and Spork only opens at nighttime, so we certainly can see people inside to eat barbecue in the daytime.
Oh, good, okay.
Spork. Yep.
Now, Spork. Explain Spork. Spork is wonderful. It's, first of all, the design is sleek but comfy. That's number one. And it's designed to be welcoming.
Yes. I mean, I think that was our idea from day one, was to have, like, a very approachable restaurant. Uh-huh. We wanted both the vibe to be approachable, and we wanted the cuisine to be approachable. Okay. It's not high-concept stuff, but it is kind of a culmination of like the evolution of my cooking career, because I've cooked in a lot of places and
you have
dabbled in a lot of different cuisines, and the menu basically represents all the stuff that I really like, stuff that I like to eat and the stuff that I like to cook. And we think that we do it in a very honest, no fuss type of way. It's not extremely high concept, but we don't shortcut anything, and everything is 100% from
scratch.
You
even make your own pickles.
We do. We pickle. We have our own curing chamber. I have a guy named John Gusto who does all the charcuterie. We have a really great, you know, young staff of people. So we make all our own pasta. We make our bread daily. We do all our stocks. We have a pastry chef, Kevin Lee Ferguson, who does all the homemade pastries and ice creams. Then we have a daily changing menu, and we do everything seasonal and based on what's available.
I like your duck.
Thank you so much. Yeah.
Well, I like your sweetbreads best of all.
I love sweetbreads. That's going to be my death row dinner.
Yeah.
but let's not forget Tall Wes behind the cocktail bar.
Tall Wes.
Yes. Tall Wes, who's perfected the on-the-menu shrub, made from Anna Peter Hayes' own pear tree. But yeah,
not only that, you missed out the best part. It came to her in a dream.
Yeah,
that would be a nightmare. Wes is really tall.
she came down and she said, "I know what we're going to do with those Asian pears."
Now, Chris, you're always moving on to something else, too. And I understand you're working on a concept for a high-rise. Is it an apartment building?
Yeah, it's a luxury apartment building. We haven't quite started on it yet, but everything's in the works. And it looks pretty sure that we'll be putting in kind of a cafe that does sort of specializes in Latin street food.
Right.
So it'll have, like, you know, specialize in ceviches and torreditos and empanadas and like Trinidadian roadies and that kind of thing. And that's really something that we're doing a lot of at Spork anyway.
Uh-huh.
So one of the things that we have sort of incorporated in the Spork a lot is sort of a lot of the Caribbean foods. And we also have started to use the smoker, you know, that we use at Spork Pit to do a little bit of, you know, kind of more interesting non-barbecue style stuff. So we just try and take full advantage of everything that we have. But yeah, the new concept is going to sort of be geared towards that. You know, we love street tacos and we love roadies and we love empanadas.
You've assembled quite a team there. I mean, you know, Sean Enright has to be one of my most favorite people.
Right. And I think he's a guy that, you know, everybody in the community knows, everybody loves, kind of like, I guess some people would say, or maybe he would just say, maybe it's just him who says that he's the godfather of Pittsburgh drinks.
he wrote a book, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, no, but he did seriously write a book about
Pittsburgh drinks.
The history of Pittsburgh cocktails. Yeah. It's really a fascinating book, and he seems to know everybody, which is amazing.
Yeah. Well, of course, he's been in a lot of places, just as you have. I think I counted six restaurants of yours that I was at the opening of.
So, yeah, we're kindred spirits, that way.
Yeah. No. So, well, I mean, I know you're just going to keep plotting. I mean, you really work hard, and you work long hours, and, you know, God bless you, and also, I think you're adoring and tolerant wife.
Yeah, she is. She is both of those things. And, you know, but I can honestly say, you know, right now we're really having a lot of fun. I mean, we're having fun in the barbecue pit. We're having fun in Spork. It's been really rewarding.
Great.
Yeah, it's sort of not like going to work, right?
Especially
2 in the morning for the barbecue.
I try to tell the young cooks, you know, if you find something you love, you never work another day in your life, you know, but they don't believe that. They're skeptical about that, but but no, it really is a lot of fun.
Well, thanks for talking to us, and yeah, I know you're busy also with raising funds for like disasters, like the Virgin Islands, where you lived and cooked for 3 years.
Yeah,
and chefs in general, I find, are really generous, aren't they?
Yes, I think the restaurant community in general is pretty empathetic towards other people, and especially towards the disasters. And I think this one really, you know, it hit close to home because these are U.S. citizens as well.
Right.
You know, and a lot of people have connections there. I have family there, and I can tell you that, you know, they can't use telephones. They don't have power. They don't, you know, they're lucky if they can find water right now. It's an ongoing situation, and it's catastrophic.
It is. It is.
So we're trying to get a little bit of money down there for those folks, and we've had some really great, you know, people in the restaurant community in Pittsburgh who've offered to chip in and help us, and we're getting that all together and trying to figure out how to best accomplish that goal.
And you'll let us know what that is.
Absolutely.
Chris Frangiatis, Chow Chow.
And don't go away, because we'll be right back after a short break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Now, if you happen like us also to adore Paris, and again, who doesn't?
Yeah, I was going to be sneaky and ask a question and see if we got a response. So if we ask the question, which city in the world is probably most synonymous with fine food? Would right. we still come up with the same answer?
Well,
you'd get some argument,
but more complicated than that.
But for longevity.
Oh yeah.
It has to be the city of light.
And you have to have asked yourself why fine dining is Paris. It's not just fine dining. It's bistro dining. It's
just dining generally.
Ethnic places, the right bank, the left bank, the Marais, you know, I mean, just
an interesting food that goes back to the occupying Romans.
Yes.
When they conquered the province of Gaul. And David... Is it Downey?
Downey.
David Downey has been an enthusiast in love with Paris for as long as he can remember. So what better person to talk about his favorite city? Here he is.
David Downey, you are indeed a scholar. I have never seen a book so dense with information as your latest book, A Taste of Paris, A History of the Parisian Love Affair with Food. How long did it take you to research this book?
Well, it depends how you count it. I guess I've been writing about food and restaurants and history for almost 30 years, and the contents of the book were put together over a very long period, so I really don't know how to measure it, but I would also say that it's as much a memoir as it is a history book, as you know from having read it. There's an awful lot of material about my time in Paris from the 1970s forward. So it was a labor of memory and of research that took a long time.
Yeah, I loved your impressions as a teenager in Paris.
Yes, I fell in love with the ham and cheese sandwich on a baguette with mustard.
Very pungent mustard.
Yes. That was about all I could afford.
I remember that I was a student in Paris myself, and people said, no matter what, you will always eat well in Paris, but not on my particular budget.
Yes, I think then and now, I mean, then for me was the 70s and 80s. It's also very easy to eat very badly in Parrot. I would be telling a falsehood if I didn't say that straight up front. Paris is just like any big city anywhere. You can eat lots of very bad food, but you can also eat very well if you know where to look.
I remember being in, when I was in Paris in the early 1960s, I think by the time we got to, we'd been in France for 3 weeks or so. By the time we got to Paris, we had enough money to ride the metro, and that was it.
Yeah, and the metro was cheap back then.
That's why it was what we could afford.
You know, it's so easy getting tangled up in memories of Paris. And the things, well, two things. One, it's amazing the longevity of some restaurants in Paris, despite that a number have disappeared.
Yes. Yes, I mean, I mention in the book probably a dozen or more, and there's certainly more than that, restaurants that have been around for a century or more.
Right.
La Perruse and Le Voltaire, La Petite Chaise and Le Grand Verfour, and there are some others, have been around for centuries, I mean, literally centuries. So, yes, the perennial nature of some of the dining institutions in Paris is really astonishing.
Now, you said that no good food could be found on the Ile de Cité. We had one restaurant that was good. It was Japanese.
I mean, I'm being provocative. Actually, you can get a perfectly decent meal in some of the restaurants I talk about on the Ile de la Cité, and you can certainly get good snacks, you know, cold cuts and things like that, and glasses of wine. But it is true that the Ile de la Cité is no longer the epicenter of Parisian dining. I mean,
right.
I think it hasn't been for about 500 years. So
right.
That's not controversial.
No, it's funny. When we first started going to Paris together, we fell in love with a place called Benoit.
Oh, yeah.
And your comments about Benoit are not especially kind.
No, but the Benoit that you fell in love with is not the Benoit of today.
Right, right. I guess Alain Ducasse bought it, right?
That's correct. The food is perfectly good. I mean, it better be for the prices he charges, outlandish prices. But I think my gripe with Benoit is that, you know, there's now an ersatz Benoit in New York and one in Tokyo, I think. And there's something about the ubiquitousness of Alain Ducasse that I find slightly disconcerting. His shadow follows you all around Paris. And I think there is a kind of strange, unmerited snobbishness about people who have the money to eat in Ducasse restaurants, who then, you know, go and boast and they've eaten here and they've eaten there. The old clientele of Benoit has largely disappeared, and those were people who knew what they were eating. I don't think the fact that you can afford to go to an expensive Ducasse restaurant means that you know anything about food.
Right. Now, I remember one year we didn't realize what day it was, and the day we made a reservation at Benoit was Fête de Mama. Listeners, for those who don't know, that's Mother's Day.
Yes.
And it was packed. Benoit was absolutely packed.
Well, the beauty of Benoit is that the decor is intact. So if you want a time tunnel experience.
Right.
Also, I will say that Ducasse has preserved or revived some dishes that were around 100 years ago, and they're very well done. You know, they're lightened. They're probably better than they were 100 years ago. So I have no problem with Benoit. I'm very glad that it exists. It's just that as someone who's lived in Paris for many years, I am saddened when places that I love are, first of all, taken over by famous chefs and then become hideously expensive, and also get onto a kind of international entertainment beat with the foodies and the foodista types.
Yeah, I love your comments about that.
So, you know, I think I'm old enough to start to be a little curmudgeonly and defensive of my territory.
We agree with you altogether, yeah. And there are a couple of curmudgeons sitting on the other side of these microphones.
But I wanted to, you probably read the review by the late A.A. Gill, because they even republished it when he died, the British restaurant critic. And he did the most hilarious review of Les Hommes Louis.
I missed that.
You need to look it up on the internet. It was the funniest review I've ever read in my life.
He absolutely tore it into the, into little pieces.
And I was with him all the way because I think it's the biggest tourist trap in Paris.
Well, there are many, I must
there
say.
There are many, yes.
Paris survives off tourism.
Well, you remember the year we were in Paris? We went to lunch at Les Amis Louis, and we had new season asparagus and lamb, and then that same
that
day, and
then that set you back $200.
Yeah, more than that,
more
I think.
More than that, and it was appalling. Peter was kicking me under the table.
Hold on a minute. The same day, we went to Le Grand Vafour.
Oh yeah.
So that was an expensive day. We took out a second mortgage to pay the combined bills.
I was going to say, that's quite something. Was Raymond Oliver still the chef there at the time?
Who was it? I can't remember.
This is the Le Grand Vafour?
Yeah.
Yes.
No, he was a young man. I think his last name was Martin.
Oh, Guy Martin.
Guy Martin.
So, yes, I went to the Grand Vafour for the first time when Guy Martin had taken over, and it had 3 stars, and it was excellent.
Yeah, we enjoyed it. We had a lot of fun, too.
It was really quite excellent.
And there's an extraordinary example, because Guy Martin is still there. He's only got 2 stars now for some mysterious reason, because believe me, the food, if anything, is better than it ever was, but the Michelin guide is really no longer reliable.
No.
Except as a barometer of things that I'm not interested in. So I buy the Michelin guide in order to know where I don't want to eat anymore.
I understand. And, I understand completely.
The Grand Vafour's interior, which in part is from the 1790s and in part from the 1820s, is intact. That's the extraordinary thing about it.
Oh, it's gorgeous, absolutely gorgeous.
Yeah, we loved it there, but we must do justice to your book just a little bit. I mean,
yes,
I can't even begin to describe everything that's contained in there, but let's put it this way. Was it Attila Hun who invented foie gras, or was that somebody close by?
Well, I don't know who invented foie gras, but apparently the first to fatten waterfowl to get the fattened livers were the Egyptians, the ancient Egyptians.
Right.
However, I don't think it's known whether they were the Jews who were imprisoned in Egypt who were doing that, because foie gras has always been a Jewish specialty, not just, I mean, everyone has made foie gras, but it was a great source of schmaltz for cooking.
Right.
It was kosher. But foie gras goes way, way back. I mean, the Roman texts on foie gras are abundant. The Romans ate, of course, the foie gras of goose, as we do today, and duck, but also of pig. Pig was a favorite. And as I mentioned in the book, some of the pigs were fattened on grains and also wine, sweet wine. And it was the rage in Imperial Rome. gras has been around for a very long time. The French certainly didn't invent it.
Now, the person who seems to have had an enormous influence, in even according to you, and I guess we sort of knew this as well, is Louis XIV and his court at Versailles. They seem to have had a good deal to do with the advancement of cuisine in France.
Yes, Louis XIV was largely responsible for the notion of French cuisine, French cooking, French pastries, French wine, French champagne, French being the operative term. He was an astute politician. He wanted to be an absolutist monarch. He wanted to wash all the other petty kingdoms and duchies and whatnot scattered around what is now the territory of France. So one of the propaganda tools he used was the notion of France. I mean, if you visited Paris and Versailles, you know that the Île-de-France, the region, is very small. It's like a sort of middling county in the United States. I suspect it's probably the size of Alameda County in the Bay Area of California or something. I mean, it's very small. And he was intent on making France into a nation, into the nation state it is. He wasn't the first. I mean, François I tried to do that, and then Louis XIII tried to do that with Richelieu. But Louis XIV succeeded. So cuisine was part of it. And yes, there was certainly an uptick in interest in cooking under Louis XIV, and he was a hugely big eater. He ate about 7,000 calories a day, and he loved all kinds of foods, including fruits and vegetables, which was unusual back then because people ate an awful lot of meat. And he loved champagne, and so foie gras, champagne, and all sorts of fruits and vegetables became the rage during the reign of Louis XIV.
Now, let's not forget the contributions from Italy here.
Yes, that's the other story. I was surprised to learn the extent of the influence of not just ancient Rome on France, but medieval and Renaissance Italy. French cuisine and French culture come from Italy.
Right. Now, the core of this book, I mean, I'm stepping back, and I can't remember your exact words, but it seemed to me that you were opening with a question about, was this fascination with food or the aggrandizement of dining in France, was it sort of a almost genetic thing, or is it really just a matter of history and development?
Well, I come from a family that runs to fat, and I will not deny the importance of genetics, and I do think that a lot of things are determined by genes. There are some very mainstream, bona fide researchers in France who believe that the French are chronically melancholic because of genetic predisposition to that. I'm not sure that I swallow that, but I will say that I think that Paris became the food capital of the world. I'm not saying it still is, but it became it and remained it for centuries for a lot of reasons, some of them having to do with geography and topography and climate, and others having to do with culture and history, starting with ancient Rome. because it certainly was not the the Parisi tribe, the Gallic Celtic tribe that was in Paris that developed the food culture. It was Rome that brought the love of food and wine to Paris, and that survived miraculously, you might say, all of the various invasions and famines and fires and plagues and everything else. And I really do think that if you scrape down below the surface in Paris, you still find this ancient Roman substrate of hedonism.
Uh-huh. Now, here's the deal, listeners. When you buy this book, open it to page 271.
Why? What's on that?
That's on page 271. Dave's 10 tips for avoiding what he calls karaoke cuisine.
Oh yeah.
And I'm not gonna give your secrets away because it's worth the price of admission.
Well, I hope the book is useful to people and not only entertaining and instructive, but also a kind of guidebook in a way. It's not a guidebook. I mean, I don't give ratings and addresses or anything like that. It's a history book, but yes, I give some tips because, as I said in the beginning, it's very easy to eat very badly in Paris.
I just had one last thought. Were you surprised that among the most successful contemporary restaurants is one owned by a chef called Daniel Rose, who's American?
Yes, I mean, I talk about Daniel Rose and his restaurants in the book at some length. I must say I was very surprised at his rise and his huge success. I'm very happy for him. He's talented, and when I met him, at least he was very modest and seemed like a, you know, not just a good cook, but a good guy. So, I have to say I am astonished at how he has been embraced by everyone, including the Parisians.
It's the last thing I'd have ever expected, you know that. I mean, especially the acceptance by the Parisians.
Yes, it's absolutely astonishing. Say what you like about the Parisians. They're not an easy bunch.
No.
But they have accepted him, and they have also accepted, you know, other foreign chefs there.
Right.
So, you know, they're not entirely chauvinistic and nationalistic. They're mostly pretty chauvinistic and unbearably nationalistic, but not entirely.
Well, I think this was a delight to read, David, and I hope that you do well when the final version comes out. We have an advanced copy of it. When does it actually publish?
The 26th of September, so very soon, and I will be on a book tour in the San Francisco Bay Area, doing events in San Francisco and Marin County and the East Bay, and then New York and Washington, D.C.
Well, that'll be fun.
Well, travel safely, and I'm sure we'll talk again in the future.
All right. Thank you. It's been a pleasure and an honor.
Thank you.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Before we go on, I should comment that David is certainly a fine gentleman. Of that there is no doubt. A genuine character, a delight to the profession, all the professions associated with food. David, thank you so much for your peon to Paris. And now we have a special secret.
Deepa's secrets. And Deepa has a lot of secrets.
Yeah, but there was one secret in particular.
Yeah, well, this book is not just delicious Indian recipes. She's totally streamlined the whole concept. Who knew that India was the diabetes capital of the world?
But apparently it is.
Because of its carb consumption.
And as a result, Deepa found herself with a husband who was not very well at all. And she felt like she needed to do something about it. And the secrets of what she found and how to make it delicious as well are all included in the upcoming interview and in her wonderful book. So here are Deepa's secrets.
Deepa Thomas, as I was reading your cookbook called Deepa's Secrets, Slow Carb New Indian Cuisine, I kept thinking, you know, I'm enjoying reading this book. What I really would like to do is, on an ongoing basis, be Deepa's friend and sit down and chat with her a lot.
That is so sweet, Anne, and I couldn't
welcome
it more. Recent radio show in Seattle, the same thing happened, and we're going to do an online book club. Diabetes Month in America is apparently September.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, I didn't know that either. So
I also didn't know that India was like the biggest incidence of diabetes.
It's the diabetic capital of the world.
I didn't know that.
I didn't know that till I started researching this, and I had grown up in that country. So we can talk about, is it the foods we eat? Is it genetic?
Genetic, it could be genetic.
So we can have a discussion on that if you like.
Well, look, we already started giving hints of your background, and it's so interesting. Tell us again, you were born and raised in New Delhi?
That's correct. I went to school in the foothills of the Himalayan mountains, and Ruth Compton came from, she was an Oxford graduate and the daughter of a lord, and she brought her fortune and started this incredible school. And I was one of the lucky ones to have direct contact with Ruth Compton, who was the first one to get me out of my corner. And I write a little bit about her in the book.
Yes, and you have a number of people who were influential in your life, and that means basically you're open to experiences, in my mind.
Well, I think that's the best way to go through life, I find, because teachers and mentors appear when the student is ready, don't you think?
I hope.
And we learn till hopefully our last day.
Well, that I think is true.
Yes.
We've been going, my trainer at the gym, I started her in something every time I'm there, I say, we have to learn one new thing every day.
This is correct.
We do.
This is the way to do it.
Yes.
But what gave you the idea? Not a medical person, not even a little bit. I mean, where did you get the idea that this essentially might work?
Oh, a healthy amount of hubris that I was born with. Where the idea really came from is, like many of the accomplishments, if I can look at in my life, were happy accidents. And so when I'd finished with 22 years of running a design studio, and prior to that I had trained as an investigative reporter,
yeah,
I'm also a painter, and so you bring all these little dots together, and we moved to San Francisco from the Silicon Valley area, and our sons were living here. It was a new life for my husband and I. And I get bored easily. And when I'm bored, it's not fun. So I have to find purpose. I find that's the only way I can use my energy, of which there's plenty, and in the pursuit of doing something worthwhile, I thought, well, if nothing else, let me see if we can get ourselves a little healthier, both my husband and I. I'm neither, as you said, Peter, a medical person. My sister is a doctor. I come from a family of doctors, and I like to say a major embarrassment to the family that I was more an artist than a doctor.
You wrote that. I thought that was funny. I mean, because I had similar experience. I'm also an artist.
Oh, see.
Yeah. So.
But the curiosity that allows us, whether trained as an investigative journalist or just born with enough curiosity to say, look, if I want to be healthier and if I want my husband to be healthier, let me retrace from that goal to where I stand and I work backwards from a goal and not towards it, what do I need to be doing today? So today I happen to be in the office of Dr. Bobby Barron, the Associate Dean of UCSF, our new general physician. And I had looked him up on Google. He was apparently a leading light in weight loss in the world. And I said, aha, maybe I can ask him about that, break the ice. Well, he wasn't the warmest or fuzziest person
I gathered
met.
That.
But he did tell me that if I was serious about this heavy subject, he didn't laugh, I should read and study the glycemic index. And my friends know this about me. I don't have a dimmer switch, so it's either on or off. The lights came on, and I decided to take all the reading material he offered me and study it for 6 months. And what happened was this continuous aha moment that everything my husband loved, well, the essential part of Indian cuisine that makes us all go yum, the fabulous biryani rices and the naans and the potato and all of the refined carbohydrate, and I'll come back to the refinement of the carbohydrate. I wish we could come up with another word than refinement. But it is what we've done to our foods to stabilize them for supermarket shelves. We have overly processed our foods, taken all the nutrition out of there such that our grandmothers wouldn't recognize wheat today. They wouldn't recognize the rice today, and so on and so on. But the fact was, we ate what we had, and what my husband loved was exactly the core of Indian cuisine is so high carbohydrate, even though it's beautiful flavors and delicious mouthfeel. But that was my aha moment, and I thought, how am I going to take that out of any experiment I was going to run without having to look for another husband?
Uh-huh. Yes.
But, you know, our last name is Thomas, as in Doubting Thomas. So I had to trick my husband, cover your ears, Peter, and I rejigged his favorite foods. And the rule I gave myself is if I'm taking an ingredient out, I've got to bump up the flavor. So instead of rice, I used a heritage barley. And I did layers of flavor, as in a biryani, topped off with an Indian gremolata that I had just made up. And the net of it was he didn't miss his rice, nor did he notice the rice wasn't there. So it went on for a few days, and then he accidentally forgot to take his insulin shot, which is grounds for panic in our house. But in this instance, his blood sugar was normal, and the Doubting Thomases marched themselves to a pharmacy and bought another monitor because we were convinced it was broken.
Uh-huh.
Well, it wasn't broken, and the rest is what I talk about. The shocking fact that in 5 days of eating just his very same favorite foods, except without the high carbs, that this could happen to a man who had been on insulin for 10 years, we still in shock. It is now over 5 years.
Yeah, I think it's astounding. I mean, you know, explain these. I've actually read a lot about the glycemic index and never really quite grasped it, but a very simple diagram which condenses all the complicated explanations I've had of it so that I think I do understand it. But why don't you tell our listeners?
It's really quite simple. It is the simple understanding that all foods convert to sugar. And that's a fact. That's the only way we absorb the energy is it converts to blood sugar. But the length of time a food takes to convert to sugar defines where it falls in the glycemic index. So if a certain food has more fiber, say, then the body works hard and it takes longer to break it down into sugar. And that is glycemic friendly. It's low glycemic. But if you have straight glucose, for instance, it immediately goes into the bloodstream, and that's high glycemic.
Yes.
Now, in addition to the glycemic index, we have to pay attention to the glycemic load, which is how much of one thing are we eating. So if we sit and have a basket full of French fries, which we've all done, the glycemic index and the load is high. Right. Does that make sense?
Yes. I mean, that's what makes the difference in my understanding is this, the GL.
But you still have a recipe for fried sweet potatoes.
You got it, Peter. You won't miss your fries.
Okay, but I mean, what did you, I mean, is there something extra in there or was there something in particular that you took out?
Okay, so sweet potato happens to be lower, much lower on the glycemic index.
Than potatoes?
But it's potato. It's got a bad last name. But it's the kind of tuber that is low glycemic compared to a regular potato. So that's the reason I switched it out. And it is still low glycemic compared to a potato which is high glycemic.
I happen to love potatoes.
Yeah, so if you like
And she doesn't like sweet potatoes, unfortunately.
Oh, you don't like sweet potatoes?
No, no.
I don't mind sweet potatoes.
Yeah, you always tell me you don't like them.
Well, I don't.
Well, you got to try it my way. I hate the mushy versions.
Yeah.
But this is crisp and crunchy, and the dusting of chaat masala at the end, how can you resist?
Now, there's another part of the secret, unless I'm mistaken, because early in the book, on page 24, in fact, you have deeper secret. Now it's not all the glycemic index. There's a whole lot more to it than that.
Yes, and I think is there a particular secret you're looking at? Because I've got lots of secrets.
Yeah, you promised only one secret, and then you revealed there are lots and lots of them.
But yes,
the one on page 24 is the one, is the particular one I was thinking of because it's got a whole lot of spices that people would say, aha. These are Indian spices.
Yes.
And I wanted to ask, so, are these Indian spices themselves part of the secret?
Absolutely, because this is one of my favorite subjects, Peter. Thank you for shining a light on it. Because India knew 3,000 years ago that all disease, not some disease, starts in the gut. The health of the gut, in fact, isn't it funny that in Ayurveda they knew this 3,000 years ago? And
yeah,
now,
I mean, I wasn't clear about that. I mean, you say that, I know you referenced the Ayurvedic medicine, but they, and you mentioned the gut biome, which I'm a firm believer in, but did they actually, people who practiced years and years and years ago, know that that was the explanation and the connection?
Yes, absolutely. In fact, the notion that disease starts in an unhealthy gut comes from Ayurveda, and it dates that far back. And the remedies are plant-based. So Ayurveda is the science of plants. And so anyway, when we come to today's scientific knowledge, so let's forget Ayurveda for a second. It's the Michael Pollans and the scientific searchers who now are getting close to and giving us data such as there are more neurons in the gut and they send more messages to the brain than the brain sends down to the gut. So if you look at that for a second, you start to understand that in addition to this fact that I just gave you, and it's new science, 90% of the serotonin we produce is produced in the gut, only 10% in the brain.
Yeah, that's interesting.
So in Western medicine, if you're depressed, you'll get an antidepressant of some kind, and it might titrate the 10%, but it's likely going to destroy the 90% because the bacteria in the gut is going to be affected. So this is now new science. That's what I mean. India knew it 3,000 years ago.
Well, that's amazing. I wasn't sure I understood that fully until I read your book either.
Thank you.
But, I mean, it's clearly what you do here is you find out the culprit, which is the high glycemic fast carb stuff. Mm-hmm. You get rid of that, but that wouldn't do it. You just rev up the spice flavor in your recipes, and it's, you can't lose, right? I mean, I'm looking at this book in addition to, I mean, having to analyze it from the point of view of why you wrote it, the medical thing and the health thing. But I'm looking at these dishes as just really yummy dishes.
Thank you so much. And, you know, it's interesting. That was filmed. All of the dishes were cooked by me personally. And they were filmed in natural light in my kitchen by Sherry Heck and Fanny Pan. Fanny Pan was Cheryl Teagan's food stylist, but I can assure you that none of it was touched up by any artificial means. In fact, there were three young women on my photographic team, and they took the leftovers the first night because I was so tired of standing on my feet for 14 hours prepping, cooking, and I didn't want to see another one of those dishes. So I said, take it home. And they did, and so the next day they came back and they said their husbands told them they are not to come home without leftovers. So we filmed, we shot all that in natural light in and did it in 10 days, 74 recipes, I think it is. So yeah,
I see here's a portrait of my cast iron skillet.
There you go. But, you know, I think what I learned is that, yes, pay attention to the fact that, and anything is, you can find all of this online today. But my research also showed is that anti-inflammatory foods are important. So anti-inflammatory has to do with a series of Indian-based spices. They're not limited to India. I really believe in borderless cuisine because in a global world that we live in today, we are influenced by different cuisines and we take the best practices if we can. And I think what I'm talking about is the cross-pollination of good technique, not a flavor muddle. Mm-hmm. But you understand if you just start with a good base, use an unrefined oil. Refined oils are terrible for you, but unrefined oils, like unrefined coconut oil or extra virgin olive oil as a base, you infuse it with seeds like cumin and fennel, which are anti-inflammatory. Put on your flavor boosters. They could be shallots, garlic, ginger, curry leaves, and then some spices that you may or may not like. They don't have to be all Indian. I very often use Italian spices because I enjoy them, mm-hmm. and they go well with my Indian spices. And then the main act. But don't end there. Think about it in layers of flavor. So when you're done cooking, perk it up with some sort of topping. I call it my crowning flavor, but very often it might be just an Indian gremolata, or it could be caramelized shallots. It could be my go-nuts. You can save any dish.
There's go-nuts right here.
Except burnt garlic. In which case you start
burnt garlic. Mm-hmm. Well, burnt foods are all the rage now, yeah. And now carbon's harmful.
Does it help with burned beetroot?
He just burnt beetroot.
I burnt some beets yesterday.
Do you like beets?
Oh yeah, but I mean, I just.
But that has to be high glycemic.
But I forgot about them.
Isn't that high glycemic?
No, I would think it would be.
So exactly. So you know, all these there are plenty of yummy options. Mm-hmm. It isn't, as I said earlier, about punishment. It is about eating with your eyes first, setting a table, being kind to oneself, enjoying a meal with somebody you care about. These are some of the things I had to learn. Where, you know, raising two boys and running a company, I found myself wolfing food down and onto the next thing. And I had to pay attention to how I was treating my own body before I could nurture anybody else's.
Well, I know you have pictures of you in here, and you look pretty good. I mean, I don't know.
Well, thank you. But that's a great point to touch on, because looking good and feeling good can be two different things.
Mm-hmm.
Can be.
Yes, I always said, you know, when I'm really sick is when people say to me, boy, you look so good.
That's exactly right. So there, I do touch on the roller coaster of emotions I had to deal with and the adversarial relationship I had for many, many years with food, because I can't speak for all cultures, but the Indian culture, we would think when we were young, all you have to do is look good, so you catch a handsome guy who hopefully is rich as well and arrange marriage and off you go. Well, it didn't matter if you starved yourself. It didn't matter if you didn't care how you felt. So these are things I touch on in the book, in my own life journey of sorting out my emotions from completely lost to somewhat found.
Yeah, but it's sort of your whole marriage and everything's almost like a fairy tale. You're transitioning. You've had so many life's adventures. But and you also have your lemon pickle with medjool dates, which I'm going to try. I have dates sitting there, and I'm thinking that this is something I would like to make.
Well, that may be the most involved recipe in my book, and it is really a tribute, intended as a tribute to my sister-in-law, who was diagnosed with stage 4 cancer. And I'm happy to say in Chennai, India, they were able to figure out what the cancer was feeding on, which was estrogen, and they shut the estrogen down, and now it is, she's been around for the last 7 years. They
oh,
gave
good.
Her 3 months. But this is her recipe.
It looks wonderful.
It is incredible, but that is not exactly the lowest glycemic.
I guess not with
okay,
all the
right.
sugar.
Okay, well, you can't have everything. Right?
Yeah. Well, once in a while, we can do what we want.
Right. Well, I mean, I'm as I said, I hope that you stay in touch with us because you have so much excitement in your life, and I think you spark that excitement in others. And this book does that too. Just reading the book.
Thank you, Anne. Yeah. I would love to stay in touch and. I cannot thank you both enough for giving me this chance to have access to your wonderful listeners. And I mean it sincerely. You know my email. You have my contact. If I can be of any help, not as an expert, but as somebody who journeyed a very hard road to what I call American success, and if you would allow me another minute, I do want to talk about the fact that all my royalties are going to Food Corps, which is a nonprofit, and it's very important. I think it might be my immigrant mentality that made me ask the question, how much is enough? My husband eventually was a big hit on the technology frontier, and I made it in a different manner. And we raised our two boys who are doing rather well, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
But the knowledge, again, which I didn't have, that 1 out of 5 American children, we're not talking about India or Africa, 1 out of 5 American children, school-going kids, goes to bed hungry and wakes up hungry. It's not
appalling.
About politics.
It's absolutely appalling.
I cannot accept it. I can't fix it all, but I can do my little part, and my personal heroes, Kurt Ellis.
Yes, who wrote the forward to your book.
Yeah. So please ask your listeners to maybe check it out, and if they are moved, or, you know, find the purpose outside ourselves, because how much is enough?
Exactly. That's a very good note to end on, Deepa.
Thank you.
It's very much like you as well.
Thank you so very much.
Thank you. And remember, listeners, Food Corps, and that's probably the straightforward address, right, for the website?
Yes. Yes, indeed.
Capital Food, capital C, all one word, with an S on the end of corp.com.
Thank you.
So now you're in on the secret.
Yeah, well, she has lots of delicious secrets in that book.
Absolutely.
Good and tasty and healthy. Healthy, wow.
How about that? But we, unfortunately, have come to the end of another program. So,
oh, and then we're having so much fun.
Yeah, so we will be with you again, same time, same place, next week. We hope you'll join us then. And in the meantime,
bye-bye.